Today on MovieWall as we complete our coverage of the Toronto Film Festival 2018. Movie Wallace, hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And yes, you as well.
Movie Wallace is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online streaming or in the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you. Greetings all.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm kind of happy to be finally doing this wrap-up from Toronto TIFF 2018. It was quite a festival.
Quite a great event.
Again, I think we said this on the first podcast, but Rashmi and I, this is our first time at Toronto. Yazdi, you are a veteran of said film festival. And I'm just so pleased we got a chance to go. I think, you know, it's of the film festivals that I've been to, it feels like the most festival-y one of them, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
It really felt like a huge celebration of everything that was good in cinema. And that's not to say other film festivals don't have that same vibe, but this felt so all you know, it felt like Toronto was celebrating with us, not just that there was a film festival in town, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it truly embodies the word festival, because I think in most film festivals, most renowned film festivals do an impeccable job with, you know, great selection of movies. And this one, you know, maybe at par or whatever with those other film festivals. But I think this is one which, beyond the actual screening of the movies, has a really infectious air of the love of cinema. And there's people like buying outrageously priced festival merchandise.
Yeah. And, right.
And, you know,
present company included.
Yes. Oh, my God. Shh. And then, you know, they close off three blocks of the street and people are walking. It's a proper festival. There's food. There's stalls. You know, every screening almost has, you know, some talent there. The director or the actors are there. There's an energy about it.
Did it seem different to when you've gone in past years?
It seemed more organized.
Oh, okay.
So in the past when I went, about 20-30% of the screenings would just be running behind schedule.
Right.
Because people weren't there on, the actor or directors weren't there on
right.
time and they had to wait. And it would, you know, a movie which was supposed to end at 2 o'clock would end at 3 o'clock, which would really jeopardize the 3:15 movie that you've bought afterwards. And none of that happened this year.
So and I love that they all had assigned seating. Most of them
correct.
Had assigned seating, and which was great.
Yeah, if there was one recommendation we would make is they should just move to assigned seating for all of their cinemas. They have the capacity.
Yeah.
They should just do it. It avoids all this unnecessary stress of people rushing and waiting in lines to try and get the better
right.
seats, and all that nonsense would go away. Yeah.
Yeah, great festival. I would hope that we definitely do it again.
Yeah, no. And again, we advocate for film festivals quite often on the podcast, but I mean, you know, we're lucky enough to kind of do this the way that we do, and we get to go to them. There are film festivals in most towns. There are many different flavors of film festivals. So, you know, there is no excuse. Check them out. It's such a great thing to be a part of. If you love movies, and I assume you do because you're listening to Movie Wallace, then, you know, do that. You don't necessarily have to travel. Okay, well, I'm getting the hurry-up signal from Rashmi because we do have quite a lot of content in this podcast. We have the last five movies that we saw at Toronto this year. So those movies are 22 July, Tel Aviv on Fire, Free Solo, American Woman, and The Wedding Guest. So we can kind of tackle them in that order.
That sounds good. And I should say, you know, I mean, we were there but for a few days, and, you know, even as we were trying to schedule which movies we want to watch, there were so many other exceptional movies which just weren't playing during the days we were there. And, you know, every time I read a review of somebody else for a movie we couldn't catch, I'm like, oh, I wish I was
same.
There.
I'm the same, yeah.
So it's, really,
it's funny, despite whatever efforts you make ahead of time of the film festival, and I have to really give my credit to you guys, because you did a really nice job of picking movies for us. I tended to go along with the movies that you'd selected, but it's amazing how many good movies get publicity at an event like this. And you're right, it's everything I've read about the film festival speaks about movies other than the ones that we watched.
Yeah.
Which always seems to be the case somehow, but I think that's just because there are so many movies getting, you know, vying for attention. So let's start with the first movie that we caught then, which is 22 July, which also happens to be my mother's birthday.
Yes. Yes, and the day before mine.
And, well, okay, it's all about Rashmi.
It's Rashmi's world, we live in it.
It is. I let you inhabit my world. Okay, so in Norway, on the 22nd of July in 2011, a right-wing terrorist called Anders Behring Breivik murdered 77 young people who happened to be attending a labor camp, a youth camp, on an island which is just outside Oslo. So this is directed by Paul Greengrass and written by Paul Greengrass and Asne Sirstad. And it's actually based on a book that came out about this event called One of Us, that one of the main characters actually wrote. This stars a whole host of unknown to Hollywood, I would say, difficult Swedish names. Sorry, Scandinavian names. I shouldn't say Norwegian names. I think the main role is Anders Danielsson Lee and then a whole host of others, which I won't try and butcher their names. But this was our first movie of the day. Yazdi, why don't you kick us off? 22 July.
Yeah, I mean, I think we picked this film. At least I was eager to see this film purely on the basis of it being directed by Greengrass. And I think Greengrass is probably one of our better action directors. He's a very cerebral, very academic kind of action director. He's made, you know, just absolute flat-out classics. He's made, you know, all the Bourne movies. He did United 93. And then I think the future will look very kindly at Captain Phillips, which I think is an under-celebrated movie. So I was really eager to see, you know, how he tackles this particular idea or this particular
concept. A lot of the Bourne movies.
Yeah, all the Bourne movies. Bourne Supremacy. Yeah. And so forth. You know, I mean, I think we are at a particular time, you know, globally and more so in this country, we are at a particular time in our history. And, you know, the things which vex us right now, which is immigration and race and terrorism and xenophobia and all of these issues, is what divides us right now. And this movie sits squarely, you know, on top of all of these issues, and it reflects on all of these issues. And so for me, this movie was exceptionally relevant. And I, you know, we saw Hotel Mumbai earlier in the film festival, which was also about a terrorist event. And, you know, both movies are exceptional in their own way. But I really like Greengrass's technical proficiency here. There is not a hair out of place. There is no wobbly scenes. There is no issue with the craft. It's just a very clean movie. It's a very assured movie. It's a very confident movie. Everything fits into each other with a pleasing click. So when you have a really well-running, top-tier car, then the journey becomes that much more effective. So I was really blown away by this movie. It's very powerful. The first half of the movie deals with the actual event, and the second half of the movie follows a person who was deeply impacted by the event. And both parts, I thought, were done exceptionally well. So I have nothing but praise for it.
Joe?
Yeah, I mean, it's another very traumatic watch. You know, Hotel Mumbai, we spoke about in the previous day's coverage. And this movie doesn't quite seek to do the same thing, which is, you know, drop you into the situation with, you know, kind of the perspective that the victims had, right? You know, Hotel Mumbai was very much about placing you, you know, in the Taj at the time that the terrorists were there and deliberately withheld information from you as the viewer so that you could go on that journey. This movie felt a little bit more documentary-like in some ways. It had this, you know, Greengrass does the handheld camera thing that he always does, and I think he's known for in the Bourne movies. And he does that a lot here, especially during what I will describe as the action scenes, which is a horrible way of thinking about the depiction of the terrorist incidents, but it's got that very, you know, in the moment type camera movement. And then the movie kind of switches pace and becomes this, you know, like you say, Yazdi, is, you know, there's two parts to this. It becomes almost a courtroom drama and, you know, tries to get us inside the mind of the terrorist here. And I think both parts are extraordinarily well executed. I think this movie in some ways had me a little less emotionally invested than Hotel Mumbai, but again, I think its job here was to tell more of a complete story rather than, you know, in some ways Hotel Mumbai was kind of a horror movie, you know, put us into a very terrifying situation. And, you know, this movie was more of a complete telling, but superbly done. You know, I felt like I got inside the lone wolf here in a way that I didn't get a chance to with the Hotel Mumbai. And I shouldn't really, I think it's just the juxtaposition of both movies makes me draw immediate comparisons. I think that's maybe a little unfair to both movies because they're different takes on the same kind of thing. But very, very well done. Movie indeed.
Yeah, I agree with what Yazdi said. I think this is an incredible journey of how an event impacted a family and many families, but one family in particular, and the horror of returning from an event like this. So the difference here is that the event happens and then we see the aftermath of the event through time. Whereas, you know, with Hotel Mumbai, it's just the day of the event. So, yeah, I think the comparison is going to be automatic because it is two events that have really happened. So I think it's fair to make that comparison in some ways. What struck me about this movie is how understated it is. Mm-hmm. There's no hullabaloo or over-dramatization. It's just very, very meticulously done. And just, it just is. It's very matter of fact in the way that it treats a really terrible event, even in the way that it treats the terrorist himself. Again, I did like the timeliness of the whole issue of nationalism, and that's very relevant to what's happening now, even though this was 2011. In some ways, there's even a piece of dialogue within this movie that sort of is a foreshadowing to what ended up happening in mainland Europe and indeed what's starting to happen in the US about, you know, this swing towards the right and nationalism and, you know, the forgotten of their own country in a way. So it does start to sort of tell that narrative, which I found eerily scary. Really great movie. I really enjoyed this one. I was dumbstruck. Like, again, I just felt this, you know, horror at the pit of my stomach as to what must have happened. And again, I think Yazdi, you had mentioned it in the Hotel Mumbai, just the randomness. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter it's who so you scary, are. Yeah. Everyone is an equal victim target, yeah. for this disgusting man.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, on the face of it, this man looks perfectly fine. You find out afterwards that, you know, in his own words, you know, he wanted a complete ban on immigration and he wanted to, you know, be going back against multiculturalism. Mm-hmm. So there's this, you know, emergence of, you know, more nationalist thinking in his head. And from that to make a leap to where somebody just starts shooting at people. And then after they're done shooting one group of people, he goes somewhere else and starts shooting more people. That's evil, right? It's mm-hmm. it's hard for us to understand when you can't understand something, you don't know how to deal with it.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that, you know, as chilling and as scary the first part of the movie is, which goes through the events that actually transpire, the second half of the movie is nothing less than this battle of ideals, mm-hmm. where, you know, Norway being what it is, they want to give this person a fair trial. And, you know, things that you would never think about in this context, which is that the state assigns a lawyer to defend this terrorist. And, you know, it really gets into the moral complexity of this person who, through his profession and through what he is sworn to do, has to protect this person who has done something evil.
Yeah.
And he is trying to do to the best of his abilities, but can you imagine how conflicted he is?
Well, not only that, but the reception of... You know, there are people that forget that, you know, in... in modern democracies, you know, this requirement that everyone has the right and there is an obligation for a fair trial and to have somebody defend. You know, the stigma that he and his family ended up having to carry because of their perceptions that he was in some way aligned with the beliefs of the individual that he was defending. And the movie did a very good job of showing us that he did his job to the best of his ability, despite the fact that he was not in agreement with the ideals of the defendant.
And I think the movie very wisely chooses that. Maybe that's the person who wrote the book, but it chooses to follow along this one boy who got shot at and who's trying to recover from it. And we've seen 100 movies about people trying to recover from a physical disability. And I don't know, there's something about this one where it's so truthful and it doesn't want to do a montage to show, okay, now he's walking again. It really takes its time. It's very analytical. It's very methodical. And I really believe that. And after he's been through this, the last thing he wants to do is go and then be a witness, you know, as part of the prosecution of this particular guy and how much, what an emotional toll it takes on him. Mm-hmm. So I really love that this movie kind of humanized a horrible event and kind of concentrated on the human aspects that came out of it afterwards. And there's a couple of pieces of dialogue at the very end which really brought me to tears.
Me too, yeah.
Yeah, so it's quite something. Raises my esteem for Paul Greengrass that much higher.
Yeah.
It's an ambitious thing to take on, and I don't know if any of his other movies are based on historical events. I mean, I think of him
United
as...
United 93.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, sorry, and Captain Phillips. Never mind, shut up, Joe. But yeah, no, very, very interesting material to take on as well, given that it was a European event. I mean, I think... You know, we oftentimes focus on the events that affect the United States. So, you know. Okay, we have a couple of movies we can go to next. Should we talk about Tel Aviv on Fire?
Let's do the Wedding Guest.
Okay.
So, The Wedding Guest is a movie from director Michael Winterbottom. And Michael Winterbottom has obviously directed a lot of movies. He's been around for a while,
including The Trip most recently. I think.
Know. Yeah.
He did that one with Steve Coogan and the other guy whose name I can't remember, who would probably make a joke about the fact that I can't remember his name. But yeah, we just saw part three of The Trip.
We did.
Yeah, he's done Tristram Shandy. He's done Wonderland. He's done Jude. He's done lots of movies. I think he almost makes a movie a year. But this particular story revolves around a mysterious British man played by Dave Patel with a hidden agenda. And the movie sees him travel to Pakistan to attend a wedding. But things take an unexpected and dangerous turn when his plans begin to unravel. So this particular movie, as I said, is directed by Michael Winterbottom. And... Dave Patel is joined by Radhika Apte and Jim Serb in the cast. And I unfortunately could not see the movie. I know the both of you did. So should we invite this wedding guest to our viewing room?
So I think this is a movie of two halves. The first half was very engaging and I was really excited by what was unfolding on the screen. And then one event happens and it all goes to pot. And then the second half was just incredibly annoying. And so it leaves you feeling just completely disappointed because of the potential it had. I think what I walk away from this is what a great vehicle for Dev Patel to show breadth and depth again in his acting. So, Joe, you and I were talking afterwards and we're saying maybe this is a very Bourne-esque type, maybe, rehearsal for him in a sense.
Yeah, I think it shows Dev Patel in a light that we haven't seen him before, which is as an action movie star. Which,
yeah.
Really?
If you know the Dev Patel persona from all of his other acting gigs, it's kind of an unusual... role to see him as this kind of spy-like hitman,
tough.
you know, very straight role. It's not played for laughs or anything like that.
No, played for laughs or any.
So it's a Dev Patel that we haven't seen before. And I think, look, the movie has a number of problems. I think, in part, no, I'm going to lay. Yeah, I don't like to be overly critical of things, but especially at a film festival. But you know. The movie's main problem is that its script makes no sense whatsoever. And I think it's really... Reshmi, you said the beginning part of the movie was very engaging. It was. There's a part of the movie where you don't actually know what's going on. So it's one of those movies that kind of starts to reveal itself to you, right? Dev Patel is, you know, he's you know, flown into northern India/Pakistan, goes over the border. You know, he's doing a lot of things. You don't understand what's going on, mm-hmm. right? The movie's kind of...
And does it do that thing that the reluctant fundamentalist does, which is it kind of plays with your prejudices and makes you wonder
yes.
if he's a terrorist?
Yes. Somewhat.
Right. Yeah. We just don't know what's happening.
He could be anything.
He's renting cars. He's
got four passports.
He's buying guns. He seems to have, you know, ways to get across borders and through security checkpoints. So, you know, there's a very really tightly directed... you know, suspenseful opening to the movie, and it's technically just very, very well done.
Yeah.
You know, Patel himself is completely plausible in the role.
Yeah.
And then once the movie reveals what its central premise is, it all starts to go wrong because it's nonsensical, and the you know, there's a kidnapping, but then there is a love story, and then there is a double crossing, and then there is a murder of main characters. It all starts to go, and none of the plot points seem to be earned by what came before. So they all kind of come at you at this, like, really?
Breakneck speed.
Yeah, so there's a lot in here, and I think the actors do a fine job. I found that their roles, their characters were kind of, you know, behaved oddly, but they sold it in spades. I think, you know, the director did a really nice job of creating tension from the ridiculousness. So, you know, it's a fun movie to watch. I can't say that the movie was not fun to watch. I found myself in enjoying it and being annoyed by it in equal amounts because it just felt like there's also all this wonderful potential. That was kind of wasted. So, you know, great vehicle for Patel. I quite liked his co-star as much as she
I've never seen her in anything else.
To the extent that she was kind of annoying, but you know, again, that's the way the character was written. I think she did a fine job of selling us on some of the hundred. You know, this character pulls at like five different 180s in.
Yeah.
In this movie, in terms of who she is and how capable she is and how helpless she is and how suddenly, you know, badass she is. I mean, it's like, what is going on?
Yeah. So. I mean, I'll give it one thing. This is the fantasy movie of every young Indian girl who gets forced to marry someone or who is scared of being forced to marry someone they shouldn't. It's like a fantasy movie. It's like, God, I wish this existed.
Yeah.
So Radhika Apte is on Netflix in this movie called Lust Stories, which is really good. I haven't seen it, but I've heard great things about it. Mm-hmm. It's an anthology of four different stories.
Ah.
She was in a movie called Parched.
Okay. And I saw she's also in Sacred Games, which is getting a ton of good press. Also a series on Netflix about a cop in Mumbai, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting... I really want to watch it. I've downloaded it to watch
on
Plane
the book.
Journeys.
It's incredible, yeah.
Yeah. So I think she's an up-and-comer, like watch this space. But Dev Patel, I mean, considering we just saw him two nights before in Hotel Mumbai, this is a completely different Dev Patel.
And it feels like his demo reel for when
audition.
When he applies for Bond.
Because, yeah, you know, in a few years' time.
No, yeah, he's please. Not ready to be Bond. No. But my point is, he was this kind of, you know...
Bourne, you said it, Joe. You were like, he seems very Bourne-esque, like a Jason Bourne.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, he's
can really
he's
hold his own.
Totally. I mean, he impressed me here as an actor in part because it's a very different Dev Patel to the one that we know. You know, the friendly, charming. You know, exotic marigold hotel Dev Patel, you know, versus this, you know, action hero. And, you know, despite the nonsense of the plot, I was with him. I mean, you know, I was with him.
So. Yeah.
And, you know, Dev Patel is putting where his money is, because he's a producer both on Hotel Mumbai as well as on this movie.
Yes, I noticed that, yeah.
So, and he's, you know, he's picking the kind of material, yeah, and he's putting his money to get them made, so good for him.
Yeah, I think this was kind of a fun side project, and, you know, they got to go to some wonderful locations in India and Pakistan. And again, the movie's sense of place, I think, was spot on too. I mean, I really, yeah, felt that we were in these areas.
I
mean,
too.
You know, I don't know. I didn't stay for the credits to see if it was shot on location, but I was very sold on the kind of, you know, international travel aspect of it as well. So it's a competent movie. I mean, yeah, there's so many things here that
well directed.
That feel,
I mean, there's some great shots
that feel great about, yeah, the movie. Just a preposterous screenplay that, yeah, lets it down. Okay, let's move on then.
Tel Aviv on Fire.
To Tel Aviv on
Something
Fire.
Something completely different.
Yes.
So this was the movie that I was unable to make. I know the two of you saw this. So I'll just go with its description here, which is Salam, a charming 30-year-old Palestinian living in Jerusalem, works as a trainee on the Palestinian popular soap opera Tel Aviv on Fire, produced in Ramallah. Every day, to reach the TV studio, Salam has to go through a rather difficult Israeli checkpoint. There he meets the commander of the checkpoint, Asi, whose wife is a big fan of the soap opera. In order to please him, Asi puts pressure on Salam to change the end of the show. Salam quickly realizes that Asi's ideas could be promoted to him as a screenwriter. Salam's creative career is suddenly boiling until Asi and the soap opera producers and financiers disagree on how it all should end. So I'll stop there. This movie is directed by Sameh Zoabi, and it stars a cast whose names I will surely butcher, but Kais Nashif, Lubna Azabal, Yaniv Biton, Nadim Sawala. So the premise sounds hilarious. Presumably this is a comedy based on what I'm reading here, and I'd love to hear what the two of you thought of Tel Aviv on Fire.
Yeah, and just before Yasti starts, I mean, one thing we should mention is we heard during, because the director came, Kais Nashif, who plays the main role, actually got nominated as the best actor
At the festival.
At Venice.
Oh, wow, at Venice. Okay, because we had
Oh, no, I've completely butchered that up. I've got that mixed with...
Dogman. Yeah, okay, yeah.
Okay, so ignore that. I'm like, but he got nominated for something. I thought he was talking about the actor.
Well...
No, that was... Dogman?
Clearly the fatigue...
Clearly the fatigue of the... Yes.
Yeah, just to Delete. Interject here.
Yeah.
TIFF is an extraordinarily exhausting experience. Yes. There are movies back to back. We were jet lagged. We were malnourished.
Yes.
And so forgive us if things have gotten a little confused.
Yes,
so.
What did you think of Tel Aviv on Fire?
So I think the whole Israeli-Palestinian conflict that is going on right now, not to get too highbrow about it, but it kind of represents... it's kind of the poster child for all conflict around the world, about which land is yours versus which land is not yours, who has greater religious might over a particular issue, you know, essentially neighboring lands which are arch enemies. You can apply that to, you know, Iran and Iraq, you can apply that to India, Pakistan, you can apply that to a number of civil wars, you can apply hell to, you know, the kind of left versus right polarization that's happening in the United States. So I think the whole Israeli-Palestinian conflict is very rife for making a commentary on a whole bunch of things which might apply to any kind of other conflict going on in the world. And we have seen some incredible movies come out of it. There was a movie called Omar, which came out, which was a love story a couple of years ago.
That was great.
It was excellent about, you know, a boy and a girl from different sides of the border who fall in love. There was another movie called Out in the Dark, which was about two guys who fall in love from opposite sides of the border. And then I think what this movie does is, again, takes this particular conflict and kind of uses it, shockingly, surprisingly, but somehow successfully for humor. And the very fact that you can laugh about it speaks to some degree of sophistication in the script, because it kind of takes these archetypes of a typical, you know, I think any kind of outside of US soap opera has these, you know, typical cliches about, mm-hmm. and, you know, there's about housewives loving them and people getting caught up in the story of it. And it also at sometimes, not to give it too much credit, but it sometimes plays like Kubrick's, you know...
Eyes Wide Shut.
No. the Peter Sellers movie, How I Learned to Love the Atomic Bomb.
Dr. Strangelove.
Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Love the Atomic Bomb, because it kind of is okay. making a lot of fun
I
about,
already want to see it.
You know, making a lot of fun about things which are obviously very, very serious. So from that perspective, I enjoyed it. I wasn't laughing as heartily as everybody else was.
As Rashmi next to me,
Who was doubled over many, many times. But I enjoyed it. It's kind of fun. It kind of wore out its welcome a little bit. But even then, I think the very fact that somebody makes a comedy out of this situation is great.
Yeah, what Yazdi said and more. I love this movie. If we have to say one film that we would champion from Toronto Film Festival, Tel Aviv on Fire would be my choice. Oh. It's very difficult to represent conflicts of, you know, millennia in a sense.
Millennia.
With humor, right? It's a really difficult thing to undertake. And yet this does it so successfully. And it's so preposterous.
Yes.
I mean, it's kind of like The Wedding Guest, Joe. It's such a preposterous story. But for some reason, it works because it's so well cast. And
yeah.
It's so relaxed in the way that it tells its story that it just wins your affection. And this kind of haphazard, almost, you know, stupid man. And that's how to describe the main protagonist. He's just a stupid man. And he's so clueless. Yet there's so much joy in seeing his journey. And he makes the journey, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a great arc. And it's just so ridiculous. But having been there and seen how polarized the situation is, it gave me hope that maybe through film, through soap opera, that those are the things that we all have in common as people. So I think it does this thing of ultimately, whoever you are, wherever you're from, we all actually like the same things and want the same things.
Is it politically charged in any way?
No.
Very little.
Okay.
Very little.
I mean, this topic is
but
a minefield.
It doesn't shy away from difficult conversation either. And there's this whole section where, you know, because it's a basically a story on the border where someone, you know, where the border guard says, we just caught one of the terrorists. And you know, the main protagonist said, well, you know, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. So it does tackle some of those things, and it uses this premise of a soap opera to talk about what Arabs like and what Israelis like. But I love that it's got a big dollop of hummus in it. Like, hummus plays such a central role, and Joe, you and I know how important hummus is.
Yeah,
it's the one thing that literally binds
all the various experiences we had in
right?
Israel. The passion from both sides of the fence for this substance.
Chickpea garbanzo bean mixture.
And there are restaurants that sell nothing
but hummus.
Right,
yeah,
right.
And they make a lot of fun of that in the movie about, you know, people's desire for the best hummus and what that is. So I just found it delightful. I would call it a delightful movie, and I would urge anyone who has any interest in the region or likes just it's a good solid comedy. It's just a good solid comedy, and that's hard to do.
Yeah, and as silly and as lowbrow and as improvised as the comedy might seem, I think it's like you said earlier, it's not easy to do this kind of stuff because if you don't do this well, or if you are in the wrong hands, this can really fall flat on its face and it can come off looking really misjudged. But I think at the end of the day, it's a story about this hapless screenwriter who is charged with writing the next episodes of the soap opera to make people on both sides of the border happy. It's a life and death situation for him, but he's forced to make changes in real time to the soap opera that would make the Israelis happy as well as the Palestinians happy.
What's happening in his real life.
And isn't that a commentary on why can't we do that in real life? Right. Why can't we do something which will make both of them happy? So I kind of see it. So good for them to do that. And I also, the one thing I wish they would have changed for this movie is the title. When I hear the movie Tel Aviv on Fire, I think it's like a, you know, hard, you know, burning documentary on how terrible the conflict is at the border. Which this is so not what this is. It's exactly the opposite of it.
Yeah, I didn't read the notes on the movie, but that's exactly where my mind went. So when the two of you came back smiling,
I dragged Yazzie to when we were looking for something to watch when you were going to go and watch Free Solo. And it just looked hilarious to me. And I'm so interested in the region itself anyway. So I'm really happy we saw this one. It was a kind of nice change of pace to what we've been watching up until that point, I think, as
terrific stuff. Speaking of Free Solo,
while we were watching that, Joe, what were you watching?
I was watching a documentary called Free Solo, and I can introduce
nothing,
this.
Which is nothing
is it like
to do
Free
with.
Willy?
I was going to say, which is nothing to do with Han the Solo. Star Wars universe.
I can introduce this one, actually. So, Free Solo is a style of climbing. It's a type of climbing that is done where a mountaineer will essentially traverse up the side of a mountain without any safety equipment. Well, I say without safety equipment, without ropes or a partner. And it's obviously a very dangerous sport to do. And it's kind of like the holy grail of mountaineering, where you can go up a mountain or a cliff face on your own without any safety equipment, literally just your hands and feet gripping and pulling your...
Sounds like a death wish to me.
Yeah, the margin of error is 100%. I mean, you know, you make one error and it's game over. Yeah. You fall to your death. And so obviously, you know, it takes a certain kind of person to do this. And the movie follows Alex Honnold, who is very famous for being the first person to Free Solo Half Dome in Yosemite. We watched the 60 Minute segment on this a few years ago, Rashmi.
I remember.
He's a remarkable young man. He is got accolade after accolade in the climbing world, and this movie follows his attempt to free solo the other one in Yosemite, which is El Capitan. This mountain has been famously notorious for being considered by many to be impossible to do without ropes. There are several points on the climb where...
It actually just won the Grolsch People's Choice Award at Toronto.
Yeah, so...
Best documentary.
Just again, introducing the sport and the movie itself. So this follows his attempt to climb El Capitan, which, you know, has been again famous for being very difficult to climb. It's considered to be impossible. Documentary filmmakers Elizabeth Chai and Jimmy Chin, who also made the movie Meru from a year or two ago, another terrific mountaineering documentary, follow Alex Honnold for a couple of years, basically to really document his attempt to climb this mountain. So what followed was a stunningly well-made documentary. I think, as is always the case when you deal with these extreme athletes, they're fascinating individuals to watch. There's something about them that is different from the rest of us, and I think Alex Honnold is very clearly wired differently. In fact, in kind of one humorous segment of the movie, they go and have him do an fMRI, a functional MRI, which is a way of looking at brain activity. And remarkably, his amygdala, which is the emotional center of the brain, shows almost no reactivity to things that would create a huge reaction in most normal people in terms of fear or fight or flight. He has got like literally no activity there. So you can already see he's wired a little differently to the rest of us, which enables him to do this ridiculously dangerous sport. What was fascinating about the movie was that it takes It addresses some of the mythology around the people that do this stuff. We think of them as, reckless or, in some way kind of mentally unstable to go ahead and do something so dangerous. His prep for climbing El Capitan was absolutely methodical. He climbed it with ropes, many, many times. He climbed it with partners many, many times. He would go away and he would make very detailed notes and memorize his route up the mountain. So it wasn't something that he doesn't have a death wish. I think many people kind of look at somebody like this and think they're just living until they die. They're going to go more extreme, more extreme.
Yeah.
When you kind of see and what this documentary is so good at depicting is here is somebody who sees the challenge but wants to overcome the challenge, but he will only do it at a point where he doesn't perceive danger. And the movie follows him along that journey. In fact, there's an extra added element of danger because they want to film this attempt to the first ever free solo climb of El Capitan, which is a very difficult thing to do when you have somebody that has to have like 110% focus because the smallest error will lead to their death. So, he had to deal with the fact that he had this camera crew there with him. Mm. And when he wasn't comfortable going, he didn't go. I mean, this is something that we saw. The other interesting aspect that made the movie so much more entertaining is Alex has recently taken on a girlfriend, which for somebody who does what he does in the way that he does.
Did you notice how Joe calls him Alex? Because now he's kind of like been in the same room as him.
Because he was in the audience. And Alex and I go back a long way. I've watched everything of his on YouTube. He's got a girlfriend who is a very big character in this movie. And what's very interesting is her knowledge of the things that he does, her acceptance of his need to do them, but also her absolute, that she's not detached emotionally from these things. She understands his need to do them. She would never. She doesn't want to stop him. But you can see that over time, they're not married. They're not at least openly planning marriage. But they've got a house together. You can see in this movie her desire to kind of move on with life. But it's very difficult when you have somebody who she's in love with, who lives in a van, who will drive to and travel internationally to do these extraordinarily dangerous climbs. That's a very difficult thing for her to cope with. But she's an excellent character in the movie. I think she brings a human side to Alex Honnold that we hadn't seen in other things. Because, again, when you see him interviewed, he's so matter-of-fact about the dangerous work that he does. And, she kind of humanizes the statements that he makes. He's almost autistic in his delivery of things. He talks about things that, like, we all knew watching the movie that he was successful in this climb.
Right.
We knew that because he was in the audience.
Right.
But that didn't take away any sense of danger at all from some of the moments in the climb. And the other interesting aspect of the documentary, and I'll kind of stop after this, is the impact that his free solo climb of El Capitan had on the people filming. Their nerves were completely shot by the end of this climb. They were watching him the whole climb. The whole ascent took about 4 hours. And they turned the cameras back on themselves. And you got to see...
And are they filming from away distance? Or they're
all sorts, yeah. So there's a number of people at various spots on the cliff face.
That would actually be an interesting documentary
that when
to
he's
watch.
Going, well, it's all part of this movie. So there are, you can see that they've... there's somebody who's trying to film the whole thing from a distance with a very long lens so they can zoom in. There are other people who are at different spots on the cliff face, some capturing kind of some of the more interesting, and by interesting I'll say dangerous aspects of the climb. There's a couple of barriers, there's a couple of almost jumps that need to be made. So just them turning the camera on themselves and us experiencing the emotion of that day when you see somebody with whom they've become, very close to, right? They spend a lot of time together. They become friends and they see this person that they care about in the most dangerous of circumstances and their reaction to that. So a superb movie. It's such an entertaining watch. It's not a very long movie. I feel like it is kind of an extended 60-minute segment, if nothing else. But that shouldn't detract from making anyone want to watch this. He's a fascinating individual. It's a fascinating portrait of that individual, and it's a fantastic
depiction. And like you said, just won the best documentary at TIFF, and it's got a main release as well.
The entire audience was just on their feet the whole time. Yeah. I mean, when they weren't gasping, there was applause at several points in the movie just because of the depiction of the accomplishment that had been made on camera. Amazing stuff. Loved it.
Yeah, I just don't understand. I don't understand these people.
I don't either. I don't get it.
I mean, I've seen Meru and I've seen McConkie, which are about these freebase skiers and freebase jumpers, and I can understand how driven they are. I can understand how impassioned they are, and nothing else matters. But like you said, when you have family and when you have somebody who cares about whether you live or die, it becomes very difficult for those other individuals. Mm-hmm. And you know, there have been stories about explorers who have done that. They can't help but explore, and they take off, and you know, they go off into the wild, and sometimes they don't come back. And mm-hmm. While I find that exceptionally commendable, it's so outside my realm of understanding that it bewilders me. So, yeah.
Yeah. Again, I mean, I think the thing that makes Alex Honnold a remarkable individual is the fact that he is no way reckless, and I know that sounds kind of like a completely opposite to the thing that I've described, but he is in no way kind of, when he wanted to climb El Capitan, he in no way did it without planning, right? He didn't just say, I'm going to go climb this mountain today. He knew every aspect of that climb. He had made detailed notes. He revisited the thing on and on. So, you know, as much as it sounds like, a madman that would do this, he minimizes danger. He only goes when he knows he can succeed, which is different.
It worries me that people watch it who aren't as experienced and think they can do it too, you know?
Yeah, no, and the movie touches on that too. I mean, there are many of his friends that have gone and died, yeah. You know, and again, he kind of accepts that as a risk. But anyway, terrific stuff. Moving on, then the next movie.
I think this is the final one.
It is. It was our final.
American Woman.
I know. That's what keeps coming in my head.
So who's going to tell us about American Woman? I guess that's...
would be me, yeah. Yes. So American Woman is directed by Jake Scott, and it stars as American Woman, a British actress, Sienna Miller, who we all know, Christina Hendricks from Mad Men is here as well, Aaron Paul is there, and he needs no introduction, Will Sasso and Amy Madigan round out the cast. the screenplay is by Brad Inglesby, and essentially American Woman is sort of a saga about a woman who we watch from fairly early in her life, who is living a very tempestuous, very, dare I say, almost destructive life, all the way up to, I think it follows her through 10 or 20 years in her life and sees the evolution of her life. It does seem a little presumptuously titled as American Woman, but be that as it may, it's the story of this one particular woman. And the description in the TIFF book is as follows, that following the disappearance of her teenage daughter, a woman must raise her infant grandson and find some answers in this decade-spanning drama starring, as I mentioned, Sienna Miller, Christina Hendricks, and Aaron Paul. Jake Scott himself is British, and now, although he's now based in Los Angeles, and he's directed all kinds of music videos for REM and Radiohead and U2 and George Michael and so forth. And then his previous movies include Welcome to the Rileys, which came out about, 7-8 years ago, and then Plunkett and McLean, which came out even before that.
I haven't seen any of those.
I have seen Welcome to the Rileys. So what did you guys think about this British man making a movie called American Woman?
Yes. Just before we jump into review, I remember from the director Q&A, although I'm struggling to find it online here at the moment, that there was some link to the screenwriter of Out of the Furnace.
Correct. So Brad Inglesby, who, mm-hmm. based on, you know, who's the writer for this, he also wrote Out of the Furnace.
Which is a movie
directed by Scott Cooper.
The director was saying he wanted to direct it, but he didn't get it. It went to Scott Cooper. So they were vying for it.
Right.
And then when this guy wrote this one, he was very interested and got hold of this one then.
Yes. So again, you know, the writer here is somebody who has made movies that I enjoyed very much in the past. But anyway.
So American Woman.
So rather like The Wedding Guest was a good vehicle for Dev Patel, I think this movie is a reasonable vehicle for Sienna Miller. I think it's too melodramatic for me. I enjoyed it while it was on, but I just found it too much and just too soapy for my liking. So you know, another example, it's really good acting by everyone in the movie. Really, really good acting. But the movie just didn't go anywhere for me.
Yeah, you know, there's a gem of a movie in here. And in my mind, what we have here almost feels like kind of a draft version of the script that needs a few rewrites here and there, a nip and a tuck, cutting out of certain sections. Because what we do is we spend time with this woman as she goes through her life, through different phases of her life, you know, parenthood and, you know, being, trying to find a partner and, you know, dealing with trials and tribulation of, I guess, you know, of aging, finding somebody that, you know, but the movie doesn't follow any particular character arc that I could pull out in a way that would have made it feel like more of a traditional movie. And because of that, the movie didn't feel like it went anywhere. It was like, this happened, then that happened, then this happened, then that happened, then this is where they ended up, which is a very facetious way of saying, you know, I mean, every story does that. But this movie didn't feel like it took us on a journey. But with that said, that's my critical stuff out of the way. I felt the performances here were just top-notch. I mean, Sienna Miller, I forgot that she was actually a British actress until she came out for the Q&A, and then, oh yes, that accent. She convinced me in every which way possible that she was this character in this movie. It didn't feel like... you know, acting. It didn't feel like you know, the movie's kind of, you know, dramatic, melodramatic, you would say, in many places. And I think that's one of the things that is probably criticized about the movie. But everyone nailed their roles here. We even had a small performance by Aaron Paul, who I thought was very good in this. So you know, overall, I was with this movie. It felt a little bloated. It felt a little long, and it felt like, you know, with a scalpel here and there, you can edit this into something above what we saw. But very, very, very nice movie.
I'm interested to hear what you think. Yeah, it kind of feels like a Yasti movie, kind of.
Yeah, I liked it. I liked it quite a lot more than both of you. And maybe it's giving it too much credit, but I got a kind of a sensibility of this movie being similar to something like Boyhood, which takes a character and kind of jumps, you know, in age. It kind of jumps like now.
That's a great comparison,
now
actually.
Now she's married and she has two daughters. Now she's already divorced and this has happened. Now her grandfather's dying, whatever. So maybe it doesn't leap as much as Boyhood did, because Boyhood wanted to cover a span of, you know, 20-some years. This one wanted to cover a span of, I think, about a decade or so. But what I really liked about this movie is that the writing or the directing never, to its credit, ever wants to make this character lovable or likable or a saint. You know, she is a very destructive personality initially. She kind of essentially, you know, detonates things wherever she goes. And she kind of has a very, you know, when you first see her, she's already separated from her husband and she has a teenage daughter and another little baby. She lives, you know, next door to her sister, and, you know, she's dating all these people. And so you kind of start already with a very tumultuous, you know, part of her life. And it kind of then takes you through all these additional events. And I really liked that the movie wants to make the case that everybody has to deal with tragedy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it comes, unfortunately, sometime or the other in your life. And, you know, how do you deal with it? Or can you deal with it at all? And I think, you know, without seeming... I agree the movie is very melodramatic in parts, especially in terms of a relationship with her sister and her brother-in-law and all of that. But I thought how it dealt with all the blows that are handled to her, you know, what happens again and again to her, you know, pretty nasty stuff. It handled that pretty authentically. And I did sense, you know, we always talk about, you know, there is an early arc, a middle arc, you know, there's a whole arc to a story structure. And I really felt that this particular character, you saw the full arc of her being who she was to what she becomes and coming to terms with, you know, herself and her place in the world. So I liked it a lot more than either of you did. There's still something, I don't know what, there's something unformed about it. Still.
Yeah.
Yeah, if I compare it to Gloria Bell, which we saw 2 days earlier, I mean, that's also about a woman over time navigating the world. And it's unfair to compare them. But again, like you had mentioned, Joe, that doesn't really have a linear story in a sense. It doesn't really have a beginning, middle, and an end, a traditional one. And nor does this really. I mean, that's just so much more superior in the way that it tells the story of the person who is the, mm-hmm. the main character. And I just, but I feel like this was almost just... It felt too soapy.
But going back, you know, going back to the point I was trying to make earlier, I mean, I feel like the reason that Gloria Bell and this have that, you respond to them in that way is this one was so much more ambitious in terms yeah. of how much of the woman's life it sure. was trying to depict. Yeah. And oftentimes less is more. I mean, you know, one of the key story elements here is the disappearance of her daughter, yeah. which, you know, happens over an enormous length of time during, you know, not just movie time, but, you know, the character's life yeah. span. And I understand why the movie wanted to give us those moments, but I think it revealed very little about the woman's character in for such a big plot. Point.
Yeah.
And again, I feel like with, you know, a pair of editing scissors, you could tighten this up into something that would be akin to the response that we all had to yeah. Gloria Bell. But again, I mean, we sound so horribly critical of this. I mean, you know, we were there and I remember enjoying absolutely every moment
totally.
Of this movie. You know, the performances, the whole plot was very engaging. It just felt a little kitchen sink.
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess that kind of ends our coverage of the Toronto International Film Festival 2018.
Yes.
I think again we've spoken a lot about how much fun we had here, and you know we thank the folks at. The very nice folks at TIFF for getting us in
yes.
to the festival and to some of the press and industry screenings. So thank you to TIFF and to everyone out there. Please, you know, make sure you support TIFF. If you live in Toronto, well, you know, wow. You are very lucky and very fortunate individuals to be part of this year round. But I guess we should in some ways try and pick a favorite if we can of all the movies that we saw. So because I've sprung that on the two of you, maybe I can just start with that, which is, probably Hotel Mumbai is the movie that will stay with me longest after this. You know, there are some very good also-rans. I think, Boy Erased would be a close second, but Hotel Mumbai was just, for me, a remarkable movie. In so many ways, I think this one is going to get a wide release, and I do encourage everyone who gets the chance to see this for what it was. So I'm not going to re-review the movie here, but that would probably be my pick of the festival. Yes, the Rashmi.
Yeah, I'm going to cheat, and I can't narrow down between two films, which are completely different in scope. So for me, I think as much as emotionally gut-wrenching as Hotel Mumbai was, in my mind, the better film, and by a small margin, maybe the better film was July 22nd with Paul Greengrass. And I think that movie, just I've been thinking about it nonstop since I've seen it, and just the questions it raises about where we are right now, and what kind of people we want to be, and how are we going to allow ourselves to be divided? How do you pull yourself up? There's just all kinds of things there, and it's done with so much finesse and fine craft that, you know, that film's going to be released in December by Netflix. I don't know if it's going to get distribution before that, but, you know, people will be able to see it soon enough, so I don't worry for its distribution. And then the other one on the far other end of the spectrum is Gloria Bell, which, you know, I just have so much fondness for that movie. It's without a plot, and yet I was so happy to have spent time with the lead Gloria Bell character and just see her slowly stumble in the right direction. My kind of film. I love both of them.
Yeah, I already said I would champion Tel Aviv on Fire, mm-hmm. and that would be my movie to champion. But I think the one that will stay with me the longest, like you, Joe, is Hotel Mumbai. It was just so impactful.
Yeah. And we should say there are so many other movies.
But there were so many. I mean, it's a really right. difficult choice.
Yeah, I mean, Boy Erased would be like a close
Laura
start
was
for
so
me.
Good. Yeah.
Free Solo.
Dogman.
So many good ones.
And even out of the ones we didn't see, so Widows is the movie which got a lot of reception, the new movie from Steve McQueen.
First Man,
the new movie from Damien Chazelle.
Star is Born,
the new movie, the writer, director, and actor Bradley Cooper's movie with Lady Gaga. Barry Jenkins' new movie, If Beale Street Could Talk.
The Jake Gyllenhaal. Sisters Brothers.
And then the Jake Gyllenhaal, Carey Mulligan movie directed by Paul Dano. And then we just heard that the audience prize at Toronto was given to the movie The Green Book, which is directed by the Farrelly brothers. Remember them?
Something about Mary.
Yes. So Peter Farrelly directed it. It stars Viggo Mortensen and Mahershala Ali. Marshall Ali was nominated 2 years
best
ago.
Actor.
Moonlight.
He won Best Supporting Actor for Moonlight. And Viggo Mortensen, we all love. And usually last year, the winner of the audience award was Three Billboards in Ebbing, Missouri. Slumdog Millionaire started its whole, you know, triumph over the holiday season by winning the Best Audience Prize. So make what you will out of it. The Oscar race is on.
Indeed.
There's so many.
Great. All right. Well, again, let's wrap up our coverage. So, too many movies, too little time is always something that we feel on Movie Wallahs, but film festivals are really where it's at. And we had a great time. If you are paying attention to any of the press around Toronto, do pay attention to these movies. I think not all of them will get distribution, but hopefully you will get a chance to see many of the movies that we've discussed on this podcast. So, let us know what you think. If you enjoyed our coverage, do let us know. Drop us a line at mail@moviewallahs.com or facebook.com/moviewallahs. Until our next podcast, which will be back to regular run-of-the-mill movie reviews. Too many movies, too little time. And yes, are you going to add something?
No.
Nope. Okay. So goodbye from me.
And me.
And me as well.